We're going to zoom out today. You know, there are two ways to study Scripture, and both are legitimate. Both are important. Sometimes you zoom in like with a microscope, and you're looking at the meaning of one particular word or even a part of a word in Scripture, and you run it through Scripture, and you find all those things, and that's like the microscopic view. Sometimes you zoom out as with a telescope, and you want to see the things that are far away at a glance, and that's kind of what we're doing today. Today is the telescope day. And sort of like those Apollo astronauts who look back on the big blue marble Earth and were fascinated by what that looks like, we're going to zoom out and look at like the whole book of Daniel at a glance in what he says about the history of the world. And what's great about the history of the world in Daniel is that it hadn't happened yet. And so it's prophetic, predictive prophecy, which is extraordinary. There are a couple things I have to say along those lines, just so you know what the flap is. You know that most of the people at your local state university don't believe in predictive prophecy. So we have to say, what is Daniel talking about here? Is he truly given revelation supernaturally to tell us what world history would be in advance? I mean, can Daniel truly do that? That's supernatural. That's miraculous. Is it possible? And the standard consensus among scholars is, no, that's not possible. You can't have predictive prophecy. There's no such thing as Christian revelation that is supernatural. There's no such thing as that. All right, so here's the deal. We have a copy of Daniel from the Dead Sea Scrolls Qumran community, dated at 125 BC. That's 125 years before Jesus lived. We have this scroll in our hand, and it reads the same as the Daniel that you have in your hand tonight in English. So we have that from 125 BC. It's true that the majority of people don't think that the book of Daniel, particularly chapters 7 through 12, the end, could possibly have been written when we say they were written. So we're saying that Daniel went into captivity in 606. Shortly thereafter, he does Daniel chapter 2, and on we go with the rest of predictive prophecy. So we're talking about the period of time between 606 and 536 is the lifetime of Daniel, and that's when he did all of his prophecies. The standard answer in the state university, Harvard Divinity School, whatever we're talking about, is there's no way that we can be right. They want to have Daniel not as a prophet, but as a historian. And Daniel says some things that are clearly in reference to about 167 to 165 BC. So how, they say, could anybody living in 600 BC comment on 165 BC? He can't run 400 years in the future and tell us what's going to happen. So they simply don't believe it. Daniel did not live in 600 BC. Daniel, they say, would have to be writing this in, say, 160 BC, maybe 155 BC, so that he can look back at 165 and say, this is what happened in history. I'm going to pretend that I'm predicting it before it happened. All right, so here's the problem. How are you going to get history from 165 BC copied down multiple times, carried over to the Dead Sea area by 125 and adopted by Jewish people everywhere, because the Qumran community, the Dead Sea Scrolls community, was sort of a splinter group. But the entire body of Jewish people, wherever we find them, accept Daniel as authentic as we do, that Daniel wrote these things in the days of Nebuchadnezzar through Cyrus, king of Persia. So how are you going to have this prophecy? We say prophecy, they say history. How are you going to have a guy in 160 look back at all of this that took place, write it down in, say, 160, and then get it distributed throughout the entire Jewish community by 125 Dead Sea Scrolls? How are you going to do that? We say you're not going to do that. No copyist was that fast in those days, and the Jewish people were too fragmented. If it did not have a substantial basis in history, a la 600 BC and thereafter, if it didn't have a substantial basis in history, the Jewish people would not have been in consensus on this. And yet we find that they are. So way back in the 200s AD, there was this pagan, who hated Christianity. His name is Porphyry. And Porphyry suggested in the 200s AD that Daniel didn't really predict this because he hated Christianity. He couldn't possibly believe that the Christian Bible would include supernatural revelation. He couldn't allow himself to believe that because he was against the Christians. And he actually wrote a great treatise against the Christians. So he did not like Christianity. He said, it cannot be true that Daniel is a prophet. He has to be a historian. So he said, Daniel wrote after the fact as actually a historian would, but he pretended to be a prophet. So that exists in the 200s. But you should know that no Jewish people believed that. As a matter of fact, it's really important to know that when Josephus was commenting on this, and Josephus is early, remember, he's about the same age as the Apostle Paul, and Paul was not very different from Jesus. We know that Paul was a young man when Stephen was stoned, but technically Jesus was a young man when he died, and there's only a few months in between the stoning of Stephen and the death of Christ on the cross. So Paul and Jesus are probably about the same age. Maybe Paul is a little bit younger. Josephus about the same as Paul. So Josephus wrote about what took place in the book of Daniel. And you'll see in just a minute, we're going to talk about Alexander the Great, who stormed through Greece and the Persian kingdom in the 330s. And Josephus said that when Alexander the Great came into the Holy Land, he walked into Jerusalem and he was very respectful of the priests. And the priests said, we have something that you'll be interested in seeing. And the priests showed Alexander the Great the book of Daniel where Alexander was mentioned. And Alexander was so overjoyed that there was a quasi-holiday called because he saw that he was referenced in the book of Daniel. So in history, there is no talk about Daniel being a fake. That Daniel did not write when he claimed to write from the years of Nebuchadnezzar to the years of Cyrus. There's no talk like that in history. Of course, you have Porphyry, who I've mentioned, and then you get all the way to 1806. In 1806, this German Lutheran Bible critic named Leonard Bolthold wrote a commentary on Daniel, and he also didn't believe that predictive prophecy was possible. The Christian Bible cannot be supernatural. So in 1806, he suggested that Daniel was a fraud, and he's really a historian pretending that he was a prophet. And then after 1806, other liberals picked up that idea, and now that's the predominant view. But you should know that that is extraordinarily unlikely, since we have a copy of Daniel dated at 125 BC. I just don't know how that could even be considered. And by the way, even the Bible critics are pretty uneasy with having to admit that. They'll stick to their guns because they are idealists and they do not want Christian revelation to be true. But they're pretty queasy about this idea of having a Daniel scroll. By the way, multiple copies of a Daniel scroll from 125 BC. They are pretty queasy about what Josephus says, just taking for granted in the first century that all the Jewish people understood this was not a forgery. This was a true prophet from the Nebuchadnezzar through Cyrus era. And they're pretty uneasy with all of this. But of course, they are, you know, entrenched and they're not moving. But you should know that what we're looking at tonight is pretty crazy. This is the Smarter, Stronger series that we're in, and I don't have any particular stronger point. It sort of is just embedded in the whole idea. If Daniel said that in that Nebuchadnezzar through Cyrus period, if he said that, then the book you hold in your hand, that's an amazing book. There's nothing like that in the world. So hopefully that will be your encouragement. All right, so the history of the world before it happened. Beginning in Daniel chapter 2, and you probably need to have your Bibles handy. I'll reference certain things today. And I have to go really fast. So for those of you who aren't used to seeing some of these sections of Daniel, this might be a little bit overwhelming. But you have the notes before you and you can go back through it anytime you want to. So Daniel chapter 2 is the vision of the image, the statue. And the statue is a statue of a person. And we're supposed to understand who this person is. And Daniel interprets the vision of Nebuchadnezzar, the vision of the statue, the vision of the image. So we find that the image is divided into its various parts. The first part is the head of gold. And when you're looking in chapter 2, you come to verse 38. And you don't have to guess what the image with the head of gold is supposed to indicate. In chapter 2, verse 38, toward the end of the verse, Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, "You are this head of gold." So you think, okay, we have this image of a man. There's a head. The head is gold. What is the head of gold? No guesswork necessary. Nebuchadnezzar, you are this head of gold. No problem. Well, that's the Babylonian Empire. You'll remember that oftentimes Daniel is going to speak of the king and the kingdom as one. So it is Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon. Arabic number 2 in your notes there reminds us that in this image, you come to the breast and arms, and they're not gold, they're silver. And again, we know that we are speaking about kingdoms here. Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold. We know we're talking about kingdoms because we are told in verse 39, after these shall arise another kingdom. So Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold and then comes another kingdom. We know from Daniel chapter 5 what the next kingdom is because in the writing on the wall in the time of Belshazzar's feast, the kingdom of Babylon falls to the Medes and the Persians. So in the book of Daniel, we have no trouble locating the next kingdom, the kingdom that is represented by the breast and arms of silver. That brings us to number 3. Number 3, you notice, we see that the image has the belly and thighs of brass. And this is another third kingdom, as you can see again in verse 39, toward the middle of the verse, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. Well, once again, we're not there yet, but we'll be there in just a minute. In Daniel chapter 8, verses 20 through 21, we can see all about this empire, the Greek Empire. And the Greek Empire is actually mentioned in the book of Daniel. So we really don't have any trouble locating these kingdoms: Babylon, Medo-Persia, and then Greece. And that brings us to number 4. Number 4, in this image of the man, we have legs of iron, and this is in verse 40 called the fourth kingdom, strong as iron. Now, nowhere in the book of Daniel is the fourth kingdom identified. We can only imagine that if you're doing an outline of kingdoms, empires of the world, what is the most famous empire of all? And the answer is the Roman Empire. And so we could hardly be wrong in saying that the fourth empire is the Roman Empire. It will come after Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And then just notice, we're not going to talk about this very much today, but number 5, the feet are a composite of iron and clay. And so since iron is represented, you know that that's going to be related to the previous legs of iron, that's Rome. But there's something different about it, and we're going to suggest that it's the revived Roman Empire that comes in the end times. And you can run those references for yourself at a later time. So for now, just remember the broad outline in this vision. What's going to happen in the world, Daniel, in the time of Nebuchadnezzar? Oh, well, Nebuchadnezzar, you're the head of gold. After you comes another kingdom. We happen to know from chapter 5, that's Medo-Persia. And after that, a third kingdom, very strong, we happen to know from chapter 8, that's Greece. And then a fourth kingdom of iron. Well, nowhere says in the book of Daniel what that is, but how can you not notice the great Roman Empire? And so we've got an outline of history from the book of Daniel before it ever happened. Now, you'll keep those empires in mind as we come to chapter 7, which is the next part of your notes. There's the vision now of beasts. And once again, you have four world empires, same as chapter 2. The summary that I've given you there, these great beasts are four kings. So you have essentially the same sort of imagery that we already talked about. These are four kingdoms, and that is specified in verse 17 of chapter 7. It says the saints take the kingdom. So that's what's supposed to happen. You have eventually God's people taking control over the kingdoms of the world. We would consider that to be an end times event. And this message is essentially the same as chapter 2. You think, well, why would there be two chapters the same? And we say to affirm the message and to give added detail. So you should know that most people can dodge the implications of chapter 2. If they don't want to believe the Bible, they say, oh, well, chapter 2 is chapter 2, and you can interpret that a lot of ways. But when you start getting to chapter 7, 7 through 12, you really can't just interpret that a lot of ways. Now, with laser precision, Daniel is homing in on world events that cannot be coincidental. So it is the same message as chapter 2, but we're getting more detail now. In Arabic number 1 there, you see the reference to the first beast. These are four beasts representing four world empires. In verse 4 of chapter 7, you see that there is this original beast. This is a lion with eagle's wings. And this is specified in chapter 7, verse 4. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. And then the wings are plucked in this image. And we can only imagine that that would indicate the decline of the Babylonian Empire. I'll say more about why that's Babylon in just a minute. Right now, look at Arabic 2. The next beast that rises up is a bear. And he rises up on one side. And he has three ribs in his mouth. Remember from Daniel 5, we know what the next kingdom is. The next kingdom is Medo-Persia because Babylon at the Feast of Belshazzar falls to the Medes and the Persians. So we know what this next kingdom is, and I've given you the dates there, 536 to 330. And that whole idea of a lumbering bear really fits because the Persians were known for their massive armies, just massive, including at least on one occasion, a 5-million-man army in ancient times. That is extraordinary, 5 million in the army. And it has two sides because it's the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. And the Persian kingdom was always dominant over the Medes. And so you have Medo-Persia with Persia a little taller and a little stronger. And that's where we end with the second beast, particularly noticing verse 5. And that brings us to number 3. The third beast is the leopard. And the leopard has four wings and four heads. And again, this is going to represent Greece. And what's so great about this, the Greek Empire is very, very short-lived. Alexander was known for his lightning speed, and that's why this is so interesting. A leopard is already fast. You give a leopard four wings, and you're the fastest thing that any person could imagine in the ancient world. And that's exactly how Alexander fought. Alexander conquered the world in just a couple of years, and he never once lost a battle. He was a young man, and he blazed through the ancient world, Babylon, Persia, Holy Land world, and nobody could stand in his way. It was literally a lightning war. And we also noticed that he didn't make preparations for his death. So when he died, he had no sons to turn the kingdom of Greece over to. So he divided it amongst his four favorite generals. And so that's why we have the speech here about four horns. And I'll say more about that in just a minute. Number 4, you have sort of a monster beast. So the lion is Babylon. And then you have the bear, Medo-Persia. And then you have the winged leopard, Alexander the Great, and Greece. And after that, you have sort of a monster beast. It's sort of like a dragon. It's a composite beast. It takes all the terrible, strong, scary parts of all of the beasts and puts them in one. And that's the diverse beast. And once again, Rome is never named in the book of Daniel. But how can you possibly overlook Rome? And what we do have in the book of Daniel takes us all the way to 165 B.C. So you say, all right, so what is after that? After that is clearly the Roman Empire, officially beginning in about 60 B.C. and growing throughout that period. Well, I mentioned the horns and the little horn in Arabic 4. There are 10 horns, and there is a little horn among these 10. One of the 10 becomes prominent. And that, again, is a little bit different than what we're studying tonight. Tonight, we just want to do things that are history to us. But that part is prophetic even to us. That's in the end times. So we're not going to say very much about that. Look at a few of the notes I provided on chapter 7. Each beast is a king, according to verse 17, and a kingdom. That's how Daniel speaks. The king and the kingdom are sort of welded together, stitched together, and that's just the way Daniel does things. Ancient Babylonian art, remember, that's the lion with wings. So interesting that ancient Babylonian art and architecture often incorporated the lion. And that's so great, a symbol for Babylon. So we have to think that the lion symbol, the first beast, is Babylon. You have to. Plus, it's the same as chapter 2. They have the two sides of the bear, one being more prominent. That seems to fit the Medo-Persian Empire, as I said a moment ago. The four-headed, four-winged leopard could certainly describe Alexander the Great's conquests for Greece. With leopard-like speed, Alexander expanded his dominion from his Greek homeland, smaller than the state of Florida, through the entire Persian Empire. To the amazement of the world, he did this in only 6 years and never lost a single battle. At his death, his empire was divided between four of his greatest generals. That's why we have four heads on the leopard. And I've listed the generals for you there, Ptolemy, Seleucus, Lysimachus, and Cassander. And the dreadful beast, as I said, is going to surely be the Roman Empire. That's what comes next. And that's chapter 7. Now, if you turn your page over and go to the next great section on history, for us history, for Daniel prophecy, Daniel chapter 8. In Daniel chapter 8, you have a vision again of Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire. And the vision is going to entail two principal characters. You're going to have a male goat, and you're going to have the ram. And the ram and the goat are in conflict. All right, so Arabic 1 there. You have the ram with two horns of unequal length. Remember, this would depict the Medo-Persian Empire because the Medes and the Persians are together, but the Persian Empire is stronger, just like the bear that's raised up on one side. You have one that's dominant, and so the Persian side of that is dominant. A ram with two horns, one longer than the other. And then we are introduced to the male goat. So look with me at chapter 8, verses 5 through 8, and watch this description. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat, a male goat, came from the west, because Greece is west of the Holy Land and west of Babylon, where Daniel is. So this goat comes from the west naturally. He went so fast, he touched not the ground. He's like skimming over the top. He's going so fast. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes, and he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and he ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler, anger against him. And he smote the ram and broke his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him. And there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. So imagine Alexander the Great attacking Persia. Huge Persia, sometimes with its 5 million man army. But the thing about the Persian army is that they required all of their conquered enemies to now join their army. And conquered enemies aren't devoted soldiers. And so as these huge armies would come, sometimes the generals would be cracking whips over these guys to drive them forward in the march because they weren't motivated to fight. And so a massive army, but not devoted. And the Persians treated Alexander with contempt because they thought that he was a nobody, that he should be disrespected. And once they treated him with contempt, once they disrespected him, Alexander was moved with rage against the Persians. And so we have the lightning wars of Alexander the Great. You see where I have Arabic 2 in your notes there. We've mentioned the male goat coming from the west, Greece. We've mentioned the male goat's one horn. He was the first king, and as it turns out, the only king of the entire empire because he had no sons and the empire was divided. We have the male goat's conquest of the ram. The ram cannot stand before him. And then something goes wrong. In verse 8, Alexander the Great, the male goat, is crippled. So verse 8, therefore, the he-goat, the male goat, waxed very great. And when he was strong, the great horn was broken because he died in his 30s. He was just a kid. And Alexander the Great was broken. So the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Well, same as the vision of the beast. Do you remember we had the winged leopard with four heads? And the four heads represented the four generals that would survive Alexander the Great when he died. Well, now we have, again, four. This time, four of these horns. When the big horn breaks off, then we have four horns. And we're going to see that there's a special reference to the little horn. So on your notes, if you look at Arabic 4, says the little horn proceeding from one of the four horns of the male goat depicts a fierce, occultic king who will attack God's people. So is he fierce and occultic? Look at verse 23 of Daniel chapter 8. It says, and in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. All right, so Daniel's getting really specific here. This is where the Bible critics get uncomfortable, because we're talking now about somebody who arises from Alexander the Great. Now, you understand, even for Daniel to be foreseeing Alexander the Great, that's incredible, because you have Daniel, say, for round numbers, 600 BC, talking about events of 330. How is he supposed to know what's going to take place almost 300 years later? Nobody could do that. But it sounds so much like Alexander the Great and what's taking place in ancient world history. How could it not be Alexander the Great? But that would require predictive prophecy by almost 300 years. But that's not all. Then we say when Alexander is gone, the great horn on the male goat is broken off and four horns spring up. And that's true. Alexander gave his kingdom to four different generals. One of those generals has control of the Holy Land. And he rises up from that fourth general, a descendant. It's going to be Antiochus Epiphanes. He rises up and he's a terrible man. He's a king with a fierce countenance. He's very hateful, very scary, and he understands dark sentences. He is all about the occult knowledge. He's a dark practitioner. Well, that's just getting a little too coincidental. And he attacks God's people. Alexander the Great didn't attack God's people. Alexander the Great never really hurt the Jewish people. When he went into the Holy Land, he was respectful of the priests. He was delighted that the priests could show that Alexander the Great was mentioned in the book of Daniel. He was very kind to them. There was no problem between Alexander and the Jewish people. But one of Alexander's generals had a descendant who would rule the Holy Land and hate the Jewish people. And so he attacks them, you see, in verse 24. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He has occult power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, amazingly, shockingly, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. He attacks the people of God. This isn't Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great didn't do that. Somebody after him in this Greek empire, once it's fragmented, somebody rises. and that's the little horn. You see in verses 11 and 12, this fellow attacks the temple. Alexander did not do this. As a matter of fact, nobody did this until 165. Verses 11 and 12. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice in Jerusalem was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down, and a host was given unto him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and it prospered. Well, nobody did that. Nobody hindered the Jewish people from having their sacrifice. Not when Daniel served under Nebuchadnezzar and all of that, because we still need to have the temple rebuilt, right? That's not going to take place until the day of Ezra and Nehemiah. So we have to go well into the future. As a matter of fact, once in that period of Ezra's temple, once it's built, nobody forbids the daily sacrifice anymore until 167 B.C., and that fellow's name is Antiochus Epiphanes. So you're saying that this guy who lived in 600 B.C. is going to tell us about the events of 167 and 165 B.C.? That is impossible unless there is a God, unless the Bible you hold in your hand is magic. Otherwise, it's never going to work. And yet, that is exactly what's happening. Daniel says this very, very wicked person is going to rise up and shut down the temple sacrifices. Well, you see the second bullet that I have under number four. There is this period of time that is mentioned in verses 13 and 14. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spoke, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden under the foot? And verse 14, the answer to how long? Oh, that would be 2,300 days, and then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Well, that's pretty interesting, because 2,300 days is the 6 years, perhaps 6 years and several months, between 171 and 165, when the temple sacrifice was interrupted by Antiochus Epiphanes. I mean, at some point here, you're going to have to give up on coincidences. This is just getting too weird. And Daniel is writing a supernatural prophecy here. That's the only conclusion that you can come to. Well, just as a point of interest, in no place here have we noticed Greece named, but Greece is named in verse 21. So just notice the rough goat is the king of Greece. So there it is. The book of Daniel said that after Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, we would have Medo-Persia. And after Medo-Persia, we would have Greece. And Greece is 330 B.C. Daniel 600. That's uncanny. One more thing to notice from Daniel chapter 9 on this subject is the Roman conquest of Jerusalem. Even though we have never named the Roman Empire, now we're just going to get way beyond any of that. Because in Daniel chapter 9, you have the prophecy of the 70 weeks, and particularly this is at the end of the chapter, verses 24 through 27. So what we find here, and there's a lot to talk about with the prophecy of the 70 weeks, and we're only going to look at one particular facet of this. And just notice the notes that I've provided for you. 70 weeks, according to verse 24, are going to go from a decree to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem to the golden age, the age of Messiah. So the entire period of 70 weeks goes from Nehemiah's career, basically, to rebuild the walls, to the time of Messiah. You'll see from the decree until the Messiah's coming is 69 weeks, according to verse 25. And after the 7 plus 62 weeks are over, Messiah would be rejected. Well, now, that is uncanny. We'll talk about that some other week. But we're not even now talking about Antiochus in 165 or 170 BC. Now we're talking about Messiah. The text specifically says, after the 69 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off. And cut off is oftentimes in Jewish writing a reference to execution. Cut off is what happens to homosexuals when they are executed. Witches, when they are executed, according to the Old Testament law, they are cut off from God's people. Well, this text says Messiah will be cut off. So now we're running all the way from Daniel's time to the time when Messiah is here. And that's quite a thing to imagine. But that's really for another day. You notice in bold print, I have the people of some future evil prince would then destroy the temple in Jerusalem. So in verse 26, it says, the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy Jerusalem, the city, and the sanctuary, the temple. The people of the prince that shall come. So I've provided for you there the notes. The people of some future evil prince would then destroy the temple in Jerusalem. That is, the Romans of history are the people of the future Antichrist prince from Rome. Who did destroy the temple? Of course, you have Nebuchadnezzar, but we're not talking about that. That was so long ago. That was the 500s, 586 BC. So we're not talking about that. Daniel says that there's going to be another temple, which again, how would Daniel know that? When he's writing, there is no temple. And he said, there's going to be a temple. And then he says, not only that, once the temple is built, it's going to be destroyed again. And when that happens, there are the people of the prince that shall come who are responsible for it. So we ask ourselves, who did destroy the temple? Think, what about that fellow back in 165, Antiochus Epiphanes? Nope. He desecrated the temple, but he didn't destroy it. That temple goes right on. You have the Ezra temple, 400 BC, and you go right through 165. It was desecrated by Antiochus, but not destroyed. And then we get into 100 BC, 50 BC, the time of Jesus' birth. We have a temple. We have a temple all through the life of Christ until we get to 70 AD, and it was destroyed. Now, who did it? The answer is the Roman people. So now we do have reference to the Roman Empire in the book of Daniel. You'll see in verse 26, I've given you the quote on your notes as well. After 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself, and the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city. Messiah is going to be cut off in the same era when the temple is destroyed. That's obviously the Roman era. So when some Jewish person says, we don't really know about Messiah. We don't really know that Messiah should suffer like the Christians say he did. You say, yes, you do too know. Because Daniel told you that Messiah would be cut off. If you, Orthodox Jewish rabbi, if you say that you do not see in Scripture a suffering Messiah as we Christians see it, then you are intentionally ignoring your own Scripture because it specifically says Messiah is going to be cut off. And not only does it say Messiah is going to be cut off, it says that Messiah is going to be cut off in the days when the temple is destroyed by those people in that generation. So you shouldn't be saying, well, we're waiting for our Messiah. If you're waiting for your Messiah, you're doing the wrong thing because your Messiah should have been here at the same time when the Romans destroyed the temple in that era. You shouldn't be thinking that the Romans are going to destroy the temple and then hundreds of years later you're going to have a Messiah appear. That's never going to happen. Messiah shall be cut off and the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city. That's the divine order. So you don't look for a Messiah after 70 AD. You look for a Messiah before 70 AD. Now, can you think of anybody in the Roman Empire days who claimed to be a Messiah, was followed as Messiah, and did the works of Messiah before 70 AD? Can you think of anybody like that? And the answer is so obvious you can't possibly miss it unless you don't want to know. And so one more thing to say before we quit. In Daniel chapter 11, what can we say? This is predictive prophecy. There is no way to get around it. From verses 21 to 28, I've given you excerpts on the left-hand side of your little grid. Verses 21 to 28. This king, this fellow, he shall work deceitfully. He shall stir up his power against the king of the south. Those would be the Egyptians. He, the king of the south, shall not stand. Both these kings shall speak lies at one table. Then shall he return into his land, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant. If you look on the right-hand side, here are the historical events from 175 to 164. Antiochus Epiphanes, the Greek king. Antiochus Epiphanes was famous for his deception. The text over on the left-hand side says he'll speak lies. Repeatedly attacking the Ptolemies. The Ptolemies are in charge of Egypt. So we have the king of the south against Antiochus. Each time passing through, because the Holy Land is on the way down to Egypt. So he goes down to Egypt, he passes through the Holy Land, he vandalizes it and oppresses it. Then the battle's done in Egypt, he passes back up north to Syria, above the Holy Land, and he vandalizes it again. And so every time he passes the Holy Land and he vandalizes it, Ptolemy Philometor mounted a great defensive against Antiochus, but could not repel him. And those verses said, that's true. The king of the south shall not stand. He can't win against Antiochus. On the left-hand side, again, the bottom part of the grid, verses 29 to 31, excerpts. He shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. He's having another one of those campaigns against Egypt, but it's a little different this time. For the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant. They shall pollute the sanctuary and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that makes desolate. That is so famous in Jewish history that Antiochus put a statue of Zeus in the temple in the Holy Land. So that's why people say Daniel can't have known this. Daniel has to be writing this, let's say, in 160, looking back at events from the previous decade and saying this is what happened. He can't live in 600 BC and know that Antiochus is going to put a statue, the abomination. Many times in the Old Testament, the word abomination just means idol, you know, the abomination of Moab, the abomination of Ammon. That's the gods that they worship. So the abomination, the idol, something detestable and destructive, the abomination that makes everything desolate. So how could Daniel know that there's going to be this abomination of desolation set up in the temple by Antiochus in the 160s? How could he know that? Well, because the Bible is a supernatural book. That's how he knew it. On the right hand side, the events from 168. Antiochus returned one more time to spoil Egypt, but was met and turned back by Roman troop ships from Cyprus who were in league with the Ptolemies. The Egyptians hired the Romans, and the Romans are coming into their own at this time. It's that great story. So the Roman troops met him, and they stopped him, they withstood him, and they said, we are in league with the Egyptians, and our king orders you to turn back and not to molest Egypt any further. And Antiochus said, I will consider your request. And the elderly ambassador with the Roman troop ships took his sword and he drew a circle around Antiochus Epiphanes. And they said, that's fine. You consider your answer, but don't leave this circle until you've given us an answer. And Antiochus was humiliated. He knew that he could not fight against the Romans and Egyptians together. So he turned back. But he was furious. So, you see the third line down on the grid on the right-hand side. Jason, the deposed high priest in Jerusalem, somehow came to believe that Antiochus died in battle. Well, he was turned back, but he didn't die. And so he announced to the Jewish people in Jerusalem that Antiochus was dead. In truth, Antiochus is coming back toward the Holy Land and he is furious. So all Jerusalem rejoiced. Antiochus, already grieved at his humiliation by the Romans, came to Jerusalem to find all the city rejoicing at his supposed death. He cruelly attacked the Jewish people. He killed 40,000 in one day. He forbade all Jewish worship. He placed a statue of Zeus in the temple. He sacrificed a pig on the brazen altar. And he took for himself all the valuables of the temple. And Daniel knew that he was going to do that hundreds of years before it happened. So a person who hates the Bible, who hates Christianity, he cannot allow Daniel to be predicting these things, because that would make the Christian Bible authoritative. It would make the Christian Bible the boss of all religions. It would truly be a paper prophet, a paper pope. And they can't stand that. So instead, they say, well, Daniel has to be a historian and not a prophet. Against that, we have a scroll of Daniel in our possession from 125. How was that information supposed to be disseminated across the entire Jewish population? You know, Jesus spoke approvingly of the book of Daniel in Matthew chapter 24. So all Jewish people everywhere say, yeah, Daniel lived when we thought Daniel lived. And we have a scroll from 125. We have Josephus saying, you know what happened when Alexander walked into the Holy Land in the 330s? Those Jewish priests showed Alexander where he was talked about in the book of Daniel. And he was so delighted with it that he declared a bit of a holiday over it. That's history. That's the way it really is. And you're holding in your hand the most amazing book that anybody has ever seen. And so let that make you smarter. And let that make you stronger. You're on the winning side.